I'm ready for different weather. I was very disappointed when I woke up yesterday morning and saw 4, 5, 6 inches of snow sitting out there in my driveway. And I know you're probably ready too, but hey, we just have to deal with what we get and be happy with it and make the best we can out of it. I did want to say, I know that weather has affected our attendance somewhat, but we have a bunch of people down in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, that a whole busload, and that's where the rest of us are. So just thought you might want to know about that. And I haven't heard anything about the schedule getting back this evening. I don't know if they're going to make it by church time or not. We'll see what happens. But we can pray for them that they make a safe passage. Last week, we were working in the Sermon on the Mount. We started this about a month ago, something like that. We were in Matthew chapter 5. It's the verses 21 through 26 is where we were. And the theme of Jesus as he's in this fifth chapter is, he's talking about what I call raising the bar. Some people might look at the Sermon on the Mount or think of the whole thing about Christ, about grace, about the New Testament as compared to the Old Testament, as a lowering of the bar, that things got easier, that things were more doable, so to speak. Actually, if you read what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you'll see that he is just consistently raising the bar from what the general thought was at the time, at his time, as people obeyed the law of Moses. He's raising the bar. He's defining true righteousness versus a superficial kind of righteousness. And so Jesus said in Matthew 5 and 20, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." And Jesus is kind of tipping us off there. He says, hey, I'm raising the bar. Verses 21 through 26 deal with the subject of anger. And I've just put the first couple of verses up there just to remind you. Surely you would remember these verses at least from last week. But it's the whole problem of anger and superficial righteousness. And Jesus says, you know, it's not just about not killing people that would be counted as a righteous person. But he said, in that command, thou shalt not kill, is also the idea. No hate. I want you to love people. And so there's a superficial kind of righteousness that was prevalent in Jesus' time. Jesus teaches us here in these verses, 21 through 26. They're not all up there, but he teaches us about dealing with anger in ourselves, about dealing with anger in other Christians against us, and then also about dealing with people who are outside of Christ who may be angry with us, some things that we need to know. And so the basic strategy that Jesus taught is to go and to talk. Just go. You can't possibly make it worse. I don't think you can make it worse. Go and talk. Try to reconcile with that person, regardless of what the situation is. But anyway, I say all that just to get us to verses 27, 28, 29, and 30. Because that's where we're going to be today. We're going to be dealing with the subject of impurity. Jesus has some teaching here about this. These are the verses that say, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it away from you. For it's better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. There was a little book I ran across back in the late 80s written by Tipper Gore. Tipper Gore was the wife of our former Vice President Al Gore. I liked her and I appreciated her very much. But she wrote a little book called Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated World. I always liked that title. I thought, man, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to raise PG kids in an X-Rated World. It was an excellent little book. But as I think about this lesson today and I think about what Jesus says right there, Jesus is calling us to live PG lives in an X-Rated World. And it is an X-Rated World. I got a phone call from a young man in Michigan. This is before I left Michigan. And he was someone that I'd gotten to know fairly well, and I'd spent a lot of time with him. I'd helped him become a Christian. I had helped him become married. I had I knew his family and done quite a lot with him. He was serious about his faith. He really was trying to live the Christian life. But he had been through some very difficult times, some very troubling times. Shortly after he was married, his wife became dissatisfied with him, and there was a divorce. Then there were employment problems, finances, and career just kind of crumbling away from him. And through all of that, he was managing to stay with it, to be faithful, to continue to come to church, to be a part of what was happening there. But one day he calls me up, and he says, I want to talk to you about a problem I'm having. And I did meet with him. He was deeply ashamed, he was troubled, and he was defeated. He, because of the divorce and because of the financial problems, he had moved back into the house where his parents and his brother lived still. And his brother had a computer that he kept there at the house, hooked up to the internet, of course. And in the course of things, his brother had introduced him to internet porn. And this young man had become addicted to computer porn. The verses that were driving him crazy were the verses that we just read just a moment ago, verses 27, 28, 20. It's those verses right there. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And then verses 29 and 30, which we've already read. Those are the verses that really bothered him about what he was doing. And I think probably every man in our congregation here has struggled at some time or another with these particular verses. If you think about what Jesus is saying. If you take them at face value, we're all in trouble, aren't we? And I think we need to take them pretty much at face value. What you see here is Jesus raising the bar on sexual purity. The commandment there is, you shall not commit adultery. That was the seventh commandment of the ten, you shall not commit adultery. But as I've pointed out in the past, with every command that governs a word or an action in the law of Moses, there was always something behind it. There was a spirit, there was an attitude that was to be behind it or with it. It wasn't just about what was going on outwardly, about not touching a woman in the wrong way. It was about what was going on inside, about the heart. And in this way, Jesus raises the bar. He's teaching us about true righteousness. He's teaching us about a discipline of mind and heart that we need. And that sexual purity in the mind is being commanded here, as well as sexual purity in our actions. There's two reactions to these verses that we're looking at here that I've encountered. One is someone who is worried about every fleeting sexual thought that passes through their mind. And they're very concerned about anything. That all that goes through their mind. The other reaction is that, it's just ridiculous that Jesus would expect any kind of discipline of mind. Nobody knows what I'm thinking. Nobody cares what I'm thinking. It's nobody's business. Nobody gets harmed. And nothing wrong is happening here, regardless of what I might be thinking. I've seen both of those reactions to these verses that, this has got nothing to do with anything. And the other reaction is concerned about everything. And it's somewhere in the middle is where the truth is going to be. To that first response, the one who worries about everything, I can't tell you how to have no thoughts. I don't think that's possible. You are going to have thoughts that pass through your mind. And to that person, that the second response, where it's being explained away and where it just doesn't really compute, I don't know what you do with these words then. Jesus is talking about something, and it's more than just our actions. It has to do with our hearts. So in a sense, I think both of those responses are off the mark. It's somewhere in the middle is where this thing is going to happen. What is Jesus saying in Matthew 5, 27 and 28? Well, he's not condemning every fleeting thought. God did design us. He made us male and female, and he made us with the ability and the likelihood and the desire to respond to each other, to be attracted to each other. There's a chemistry that exists. We're wired for this. This is how God made us. And what's amazing is that chemistry or that wiring works regardless if you're married or not. And it works whether you are a Christian or not. That seems to have nothing much to do with it. But that chemistry or that wiring is there. And those thoughts do come. And the real question then is, what does a Christian man do with those thoughts? Our job is to let them pass on through. We are not to give them resonance. It's not something that we allow to dwell in our minds and our hearts. What Jesus is condemning here, I believe, is when thoughts come through and we don't let them pass through. We close the back door. We welcome them in. We give them a home. We give them a dwelling place. In fact, we might even devise ways to stimulate those thoughts and fantasize about things that are anything but pure. And our job as Christians, as I say, is to let them pass on through, to develop a certain discipline of mind, a discipline of mind that we have to learn. I want you to look at verses 29 and 30 now. Let's read those again. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose some of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. These verses, the ones we were just looking at a moment ago, and these verses right here, I've read them together because I think there is a connection. The connection is Jesus is kind of giving us a strategy about what to do about the problem of verses 27 and 28. How will you tackle this? How will you go after this? The lust of the heart is often stimulated by what we see. The lust of the heart is often stimulated by the hand. And I really can't go too much further with this. But I think I know what these verses are about, and I think I know exactly what they mean. But I really can't say those things to a mixed audience. That's why we have a class called PG Men. And on Wednesday nights, that's the stuff we're talking about. It's stuff that would be totally embarrassing to say in the presence of people of the opposite sex. But Jesus had a way of talking about very delicate subjects, didn't he? And he refers to the eye and the hand and the problem of the impure heart. I think Jesus shows us here how serious this matter is to him. And it's a matter not taken very seriously by our society. We have kind of lost our sense of shame. There used to be some things that were shameful in American society. But the list is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. I don't know what it is that anybody would be ashamed of anymore. We were created with the ability to feel shame. Not initially. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 25, and just after God has made Eve and he's introduced Adam and Eve to each other, and therefore a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife. They two become one flesh. That's verse 24. And then it says, and the man and his wife were both naked, and they were not ashamed. There was a time of innocence there in the garden. God had more to do with those two people than what we see. But then you get over to chapter 3 and verse 7. And this is after the serpent has showed up, and he's talked with Eve and convinced her that she needs to eat the fruit, the forbidden fruit. And she's taken her bite, and she's handed it over to Adam. They both have eaten the fruit now. And there's this comment, then the eyes of both of them were opened. And they knew that they were naked. And now that sense of shame that wasn't there, chapter 2 and verse 25, comes on. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. From the time of that verse right there, from the time of the fall until this present time, a sense of shame is standard equipment in a human being. It's there. It's a part of who we are. And it's a part, it's God's will that we be equipped that way. You can lose it, you can destroy it. By repeated violation of that shame, you can eventually lose it, and I think a lot of people have. But in our society, I sense that there's been a loss of a sense of shame. Immorality and perversion is on parade almost every day. And the more outrageous something is, the better, as far as some people are concerned. I don't know if the Jerry Springer show is still on TV or not, But that is a show, or shows like that, are shows where immorality and perversion are viewed as entertainment, and they are applauded and they are rewarded in many different ways. And it's come to the point where those who are involved in what I'll call shameful things are no longer content to be tolerated, but they ask now to be respected and to be held up as examples. If you have no shame, you cannot take this matter of the impure heart seriously, these verses that we were just reading of Jesus. Two things show us how serious Jesus was about all this. First of all, it has to do with the radical measures that he taught. Going back to verses 29 and 30, this is slide 13. There were some radical measures being proposed here by Jesus for handling this problem. He says, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it's better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. That's a pretty radical measure there. And I think Jesus may be using, I don't know that he means it literally. I think it's probably hyperbole. But by saying it just that way, he's telling us just how serious he is about it. He's proposing something very radical here. And then there's a radical punishment that Jesus talks about if we don't address it, if we don't get a hold of it. So here we are in both cases. It's better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. That's how both of these radical things that Jesus says to do, that's where it's headed. We don't get that under control. He mentions the word hell. The word hell is translated from a Greek word, Gehenna. And Gehenna is actually from a Hebrew word, which means the Valley of Hinnom, Gehenna, Valley of Hinnom, or Gehenna. And in pronouncing it quickly, you sometimes end up with just Gehenna rather than Gehenna. But it's a reference to a valley located not far from the walls of the ancient city of Jerusalem, the Valley of Hinnom. It was the site of worship in the, if you went back 600, 700, 800 years before the time of Christ, that Valley of Hinnom had become a place of worship where the god of the Sidonians named Molech was worshipped. And part of the worship of Molech involved taking your sons and maybe your daughters. I can't remember if the daughters were involved or not, but you took your son, you built a fire to Molech, and you threw your child into the fire. And somehow that was that made Molech happy. The particular place of the valley, the Valley of Hinnom, that was called, they had a name where all this worship happened, was called Topheth. Topheth means place of burning. And it was called place of burning because that's where the altar of Molech was. What is amazing to me is that there were two kings in Judah. Judah was the faithful remnant of God's people, the two faithful tribes of God's people. Israel had already gone this way 100 years before. But two kings of Judah, the faithful, were involved in the sacrifice of their sons in Topheth to the god of Molech. Ahaz is the first one I'll mention, 2 Chronicles chapter 28. Let's read those first three verses. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do right in the sight of the Lord, as David his father had done. But he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He also made molten images for the Baals. Moreover, he burned incense in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. That's what we're talking about, Gehenna, the valley of Hinnom. And burned his sons in fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel. A couple generations later, another king comes along, a king of Judah. His name is Manasseh. This is 2 Chronicles chapter 33 and verse 6. He, Manasseh, made his sons pass through the fire in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. And he practiced witchcraft, used divination, practiced every sorcery, practiced sorcery and dealt with mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. And so here are this is the righteous remnant of God, of the 12 tribes, Judah and Benjamin together. And they end up being the kings of those of that righteous remnant end up worshiping the god Molech. They are burning their sons in the fire of Topheth, the valley of Hinnom. The grandson of Manasseh comes along not too many years later. This is about 625 B.C. Josiah comes to the throne of Judah. And a comment is made there. This is 2 Kings chapter 23 and verse 10. Josiah is the young king who is known for his reforms. He found the law in the temple, and he had his people read it. He restored so much of the worship of Jehovah in the land of Judah. But there's a comment made in all the things that Josiah did. Here's this one comment about Josiah. He also defiled Topheth, that place of burning. He defiled it, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, that no man might make his son or his daughter pass through the fire for Molech. Josiah saw what was wrong here. He saw how crazy this was, how evil this was. And it says he defiled Topheth. Well, what is it that he did? I think this is interesting. Josiah turned the valley of Hinnom, the entire valley, into the city dump for Jerusalem. It was a place where everyone took their filth and their garbage and their rot. It was a place that was full of maggots because of the organic materials that were being deposited there. It was where you took your old mattresses, your old whatever you want to get rid of. And in 625 B.C., Josiah turned that valley into the city dump. They set fire to the things that were in that dump in 625 B.C. And 625 years later, when Jesus shows up, it's still burning in the valley of Hinnom. It's still smoking and smoldering. It hasn't quit for 625 years. The maggots are still there eating the putrid flesh or the putrid organic materials, whatever they are. It's all there. It's all just rotting and smoldering, stinking, smoking and burning. And when you said the valley of Hinnom, that's what you thought. That was the city dump. So, I'm getting back to this point here. For 625 years, the people of Israel knew Gehenna as the place of burning, a place that had never gone out, a place full of maggots and filth and all. And so by the time of Jesus, that word, Gehenna, was being used to talk about the place of eternal punishment. Jesus is so serious about this, that those who refuse to deal with it, with this impurity of the heart, he says, are destined for hell. Now, Jesus has a strategy here for dealing with adultery of the heart, or for any temptation to sin, for that matter. And like I said, it is a radical thing. The first thing he says to do is pluck out your eye or cut off your hand. And like I say, I don't know that he means that. I really don't think he meant that literally, but I think he said, you know, you're going to do something radical here, something incredible. And what he's actually teaching us is to cut off our ability to sin. I mean, to just put it in a simpler way, cut off your ability to sin. There's various things you can do for that. This same thought comes up in Mark chapter 9, verses 42 through 48. It's a different kind of context, but Jesus is getting right at the same thing. Again, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe to stumble, it would be better for him if, with a heavy millstone hung around his neck, he'd been cast into the sea. Now here we go. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life crippled than having your two hands to go into hell, into the unquenchable fire, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Verse 45. If your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. What's he talking about? If you're prone to go to places you shouldn't go, cut your feet off. Cut your foot off. It's better for you to enter life lame than having your 2 feet to be cast into hell, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. If your eye causes you to stumble, what's he talking about? Well, I'm looking at things that you shouldn't be looking at. If your eye causes you to stumble, throw it out. It's better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than having 2 eyes to be cast into hell, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Jesus is talking about cutting off your ability to sin. That's his strategy here. You get to this same idea in Romans chapter 13 and verse 14. This is the Apostle Paul talking to the Christians in the Roman church. He says, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust. And it's those words, that last line, make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust. There are a lot of things as you go through life the first time. Well, you only go through life once, but I'm saying there are a lot of things you encounter for the first time where you don't know exactly what's going to happen. You just walk into it and very innocently end up in a bad situation. And that's happened to me, that's happened to you, where you did not know what was waiting for you when you got there. When you got there, you found out, oh, this is bad, I need to get out of here, or something along that line. People walk very innocently, unknowingly into bad situations, into bad circumstances from time to time, and find themselves sinning and doing things they shouldn't be doing. It's one thing for that to happen one time or twice. But for you to keep going back to that place, eventually you understand you're giving into it. You're setting yourself up for it. The fact that you're even thinking about going there means that you are setting the table. You're setting the plate, so to speak, to be involved in something you know you shouldn't. The strategy ought to be make no provision for the flesh. Don't set yourself up to do things. You've already failed there. Don't set yourself up again to do the same thing again. Make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust. Same idea comes out in 1 Corinthians 15, 33 and 34. Paul's talking to the Corinthian church now. He says, do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Become sober-minded as you ought and stop sinning, for some have no knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. But you see what Paul is saying here? He says, you know, there's some people you can get around that are not, guess what? Bad company corrupts good morals. They influence you. And you know, I know everyone's had some friends or someone who, that when you went with them, you know, bad things start to happen. That they tend to take you to places and get you involved in things that you really don't need to be involved in. And if you keep going back to that person and back to those same circumstances, you're setting yourself up again. He says you need to cut yourself off. You need to limit your association with that person. You need to limit. You need to cut yourself off from that setting up of yourself for sin. For every sin, there is a time and a place, circumstances, people, a means. There's all those things that have to be there that make it easy for you to choose those things. What Jesus says, he says, cut off the time, cut off the places, cut off the situations, the persons, the means, and you have a chance of winning the battle. But if you don't, you are lost. Now let's apply this to the issue of the adultery of the heart. First of all, let's talk about the eye. The psalmist said, this is Psalm 101, verse 3. This is a great verse. David said, I will set no unclean thing before my eyes. I will set no unclean thing before my eyes. We're talking about the eye now. There are all kinds of things that we see, things that we shouldn't. They may come to us by way of cable TV. What do you do with that? Well, I hope you can eliminate those channels if necessary, or cancel the subscription or whatever it is. There are things that come to us by way of the smartphone. And I don't know what you do with that exactly. I don't know what kind of controls there are. But if you have to, take your hammer out and smash that phone and forget it. Go do something else. And there may be a situation involved with your computer and your access to the internet. And if you need to, it's time to just throw it out. Get it out of your house. Because Jesus is dead serious about this matter. He's dead serious about impurity. There are people that we may need to avoid. We need to avoid the ones, especially where we feel a chemistry with them. We need to be very careful. We need to avoid what I call X-rated people. There's some of us, some who just drag us into the gutter when we're around them, and you can't allow that. And there are some places where we just cannot go. And we need to cut ourselves off from those places. And there are some situations where we are just cannot allow ourselves to get into them. Otherwise, all of this thing with the eye, with the heart, the impurity, it's all brought back again. And we are going against the teaching of our Lord. Jesus' strategy is this. You know where you're weak. You know where your sin is. Cut it off at the pass. Cut off your ability to do those things. And why does Jesus say this? Well, he's already given us one reason why. He says, I don't want you to go to hell. But I'm asking why in another way. Why is Jesus so concerned about the purity of the heart? Look at Proverbs 4 and 23. Watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life. Real life comes out of your heart. And if you pollute the waters of your heart, it's not a very good life. Proverbs 23 and 7. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Got to watch out for your heart. It needs to be clean. It needs to be holy and useful to God. I saw or heard a little saying one time, and it really fits in here for me anyway. It goes like this: sow a thought, reap an action. Sow an action, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a lifestyle. Sow a lifestyle, reap a destiny. And the thing I want you to see is that there's a connection between destiny and thought. It all starts with the inside. What is going on inside of us? You have to be careful about those things, because those thoughts can determine a destiny. So the heart is the real battleground. And in the Beatitudes, Jesus said this, is Matthew 5 and 8. He said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And then he said, the Apostle Paul said to the men of the Ephesian church, he says, therefore I want the men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands without wrath and dissension. He wanted men who were able to pray, whose hands were clean, they were holy. And that comes out of a holy heart. Now, I've said all this. I don't know what I want to say right now. This is something that's very hard, I think, for women to understand. And that's why we have that class. That's why we're having the class. It's for men. And this is a problem for the most part. I know there are some women who have problems with this purity thing. And for the same reasons that men do. But for the most part, it's a man's problem. And I notice this, or I believe this, I do not believe that women really understand their men. And it makes it very hard. We cannot talk about these things with you because you misinterpret what is going on. It's good that we have that class, PG Men. It's good that we're talking about these things. We're talking about the stuff that we cannot mention to our wives, to our sisters in Christ, to our mothers. We're talking about that stuff. And our class is, at this point, is fairly small. It's 12, 13, 14 people, something like that. And we're going to keep running this thing here, because I know there's a bunch more guys in this congregation. I know there's a bunch more guys that really need to be in there, need to know what we're talking about, what we're doing. And I urge you to come. And I think that's everything I want to say. Maybe there's someone here who is not a Christian. And we're going to sing a hymn of invitation. And if you need to respond to the invitation of Christ to become a child of God, to believe in Him, to repent of your sins, to be baptized in the name of Christ, then we're inviting you to come and take care of that today. This is your day. And maybe there is a Christian here, and there's something that they need to get straightened out, something they need to be taken care of. This invitation is for you also. Let's stand and sing our hymn.